Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
I'm delighted to share this series is in partnership with Heck. Being an independent and family-owned business, they pull out all the stops to bring that farmer's market quality to the supermarket shelf. If you believe that healthy eating is expensive, you're not alone. The BBC say up to 80% of the UK struggle to afford healthy food. But let me assure you, it just isn't true. And importantly, cheap does not necessarily mean unhealthy. Yet one food I cannot defend is cheap sausages. You know the ones I mean. Seriously, buy the food you can afford and enjoy it, but if you love sausages, you'll love Heck. There's chicken, pork, veggie, and all sorts of varieties in your local supermarket, or check out heckfood.co.uk. And remember, when it comes to sausages, the healthiest tend to be those with a high meat or veg content, because it usually means there's less unnecessary stuff being used to bulk them out. Hello, and thank you so much for tuning in to Food for Thought, a podcast on a mission to equip you with all the evidence-based advice you need to live and breathe a healthy lifestyle. I'm Rhiannon Lambert, registered nutritionist, founder of Retrition, London's leading private nutrition clinic, and author of Renourish and Top of Your Game. In each episode, I'll be joined by special guests, all of whom can be considered authoritative voices in health, so that together we can learn fact from fiction and empower the healthiest and happiest versions of ourselves with trusted expert advice. We are under so much pressure to be happy. The market has exploded with self-help books, and we see post after post on Instagram telling us to embrace our lives to the full. But is it truly possible to be happy all the time? Are human emotions like sadness and anger to be avoided at all costs, or are they in fact a fundamental component of human nature? And how can we be told to be happy 24/7 when in the same breath we're also told not to be ashamed of negative emotions? Either way, with depression rates at an all-time high and stress levels surging, it seems we haven't quite got happiness figured out. Joining me to discuss the science behind happiness is Paul Dolan, Professor of Behavioural Science and expert on human behaviour and happiness, to understand what truly makes us happy. Hello, Professor Dolan.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much for giving your time to come on the podcast today. I think I want to start by saying the ultimate question.
Yeah.
Is it really possible to make ourselves happy? Or is it out of our control?
Okay, well, that's a good place to start. Mm. Why don't you start with an easy one, honestly?
I know,
wow, okay.
I know.
So, of course, there's going to be differences across individuals by genes, by temperament, just simply, you know, we all experience that in our everyday lives, don't we? Some people that we know are just naturally happier than others. Mm-hmm. But irrespective of your baseline, there are things that each of us can do to be happier. And actually, most of what I argue is in actually what you do. It is what you do to be happier. Not so much ways in which you think yourself happier, but by doing stuff. We can talk about some of those things if you want. But it's a much more of an action-based approach to happiness.
Which is interesting, because is there a way that we can check? I mean, how do you know what is actually meant by happiness? What is the kind of definition? Is it to do with our brains, or?
Well, it's about how we feel.
Yeah.
So. I argue in my first book, Happiness by Design, that it's about the flow of pleasure and purpose.
Yeah.
So experiences that we have that feel like they're fun, but also some things that we do that feel fulfilling.
Yeah.
And happy lives are ones that then find the right balance for that individual, because it's going to clearly differ across people, that find the right balance between pleasure and purpose, between fun and fulfillment.
It's so interesting you say that, and what you said actually just as we started, that it's an action, because sometimes I find myself on a day when it's a bit more of a struggle. I'm an ex-performer, but I can very quickly switch into, I don't know, almost making myself happier, like you say, kind of imagining that I can become it, and then I do.
Yeah, so if you think about the self-help industry, because it is an industry, right? It's a massive industry. Those books sell so many copies because they don't work, because of course you buy one and it says things like be positive. Well, you kind of know that, right? But how do you do it? It's about implementing those intentions and just kind of having the desire or the intention or the belief to be happier isn't going to work. It's going to need you to do stuff, engage in activities, you know, spend time with people that you like being with. Some of these things are really obvious insights, but they get over, but often get overlooked as we kind of get caught up in the daily machinations of life.
Well, we do. And I was also reading that the Scandinavian countries apparently are the happiest in the world. So what actually makes these countries so happy then? And why haven't we got it right in the UK? Is it their lifestyle?
Well, so one thing that's worked, so I'm interested in measurement of happiness as well as what things affect it. So when we talk about Scandinavians, for example, being happiest, it's typically on measures where we ask people overall, how satisfied are you with your life these days? So it's a very simple global question about life overall and not necessarily about how people are feeling moment to moment. So whilst those data are helpful sometimes, I don't think they speak directly to the kind of conversation that we're having about happiness and about what people do and how they feel.
Yeah.
And also there are huge translational issues, right? So the word happiness in one language might not mean the same thing in another language. And there's variation by the way in which you ask the question, whether you ask people over the phone or face to face. So we need to be careful about drawing comparisons across nations based on those kinds of data.
Yeah.
And particularly also in the life satisfaction data. When I ask you overall how satisfied you are with your life, you're going to construct a narrative about the things that you think should make you happy.
Straight away, I think, how am I with my life? My work, my relationships?
Exactly. And that's I talk a lot more about that in my second book, Happy Ever After, which is about these narratives that you kind of are expected to have achieved in order to be a grown-up or to be a successful person, right? So you're meant to be wealthy, successful,
the
clever.
The norms in society.
Get married, have children, all these things that are expected of you. And so in those evaluations of life, there's going to be a large part of that tick box, if you like, that have I achieved these things that are expected of me, and sometimes they're very weakly associated with happiness, with how people feel day to day.
I mean, do you know where the UK sits then in this, I don't know, list of ratings?
As I say, I'm not a huge fan of these international comparisons, so you know, we kind of do, as with most things, fair to middling.
that's kind of standard British way Exactly. And according to the World Health Organization, so I've been doing a little bit of research.
You have been doing some research, haven't you? You've been reading up on this stuff.
I know.
You're going to know more about this than I do.
We are an evidence-based podcast, but more than 300 million people suffer with depression globally, and it's on the rise. So when you've just said about actioning things and having a societal norm, what do you think is making us less happy than we used to be, if it's always been the same?
It's a good question. I mean, it's really difficult to make those comparisons across time, because of course not only do we change the way that we measure things, what people report as being depression is different across different cohorts, and so again, you know, it's kind of a boring answer, but we need to be careful about how we interpret those data. But insofar as depression is on the increase, then, you know, it's interesting, as you say, to kind of explore some of the reasons why. I think we are caught, and this is what the second book's much more about, we are caught in these narratives about what we ought to have done with our lives in order to be happy and, you know, get a good job, get married, have kids, all these things that are kind of expected of you. And for a lot of people, those things don't make them happy. And there was a book, I don't know, back in the 80s called Don't Sweat the Small Stuff. I actually argue that everything is actually in the small stuff, you see, because whilst we're motivated by and striving towards success, for example, you know, working long hours or, you know, trying to get on at work, we're often trading off some of the things in our daily experiences that would make us feel happy.
So true.
Like spending time with people that we like being with, like going outdoors, like listening to music. All the things that are obviously good for us, but they get crowded out as we get driven by these other ambitions.
The fact you even mentioned going outdoors, but it's so true, because I find myself even, I'm sure loads of people listening can relate, that when you're working so hard and so many hours, sometimes you rarely see nature every day. And if we're discussing money, I think let's pick money as the first thing.
Okay, let's start with money.
Yes, because I think a lot of people define their happiness sometimes on the fact that they're earning money. And I recently also read that researchers suggested that the amount of money is the thing that can make us happy compared to just having enough and being relatively comfortable.
Yeah.
What
so,
do you think about that?
So the first thing is, it's really worth emphasizing that poverty makes people miserable.
Yeah.
Right. So that, you know, if you're, and it's really a lot about what we pay attention to. Mm. This is much more in the first book is, you know, we are what we pay attention to. How we feel and what we do is driven by where we pay attention. So if you're resource scarce, you're worrying about how you're going to pay the bills, feed the kids, pay the rent or whatever. Mm. That's very attention seeking in negative ways. But once you get to sort of basic sort of mean levels of income, you stop paying attention to those things to the same degree and you kind of get on with more of enjoying the money, if you like.
Yeah.
But interestingly, what could happen is as you get richer is that you might start paying attention to money in a different way. Like, so have I got the right investments? Do I have the right stocks and shares?
And added stress.
You know, and you get added stress. So, so there kind of might be, I mean, the evidence, you know, the first thing, one thing to always say is that we have no randomized controlled trials. So we don't allocate people to different conditions. So we can't look at the true causal effects of income, for example, which is very hard to do. But the correlations are interesting and you know, we can at least discuss what they might say. And and at some of the higher levels of income in people's experiences of happiness, there's some evidence to suggest that they actually start not only not increasing, but actually decrease. So there might be a kind of sweet spot, if you like.
Yeah, it's like that phrase, money doesn't buy happiness.
No, money, but as I say, you know, poverty does buy misery.
Well, yes.
But it's about what you pay attention to. And once you... You know, the thing, the reason money matters so much to us in our aspirations is partly because we want to compete with other people and you know, do well relative to them, but also because we imagine that when we get a pay rise, for example, that we're going to continue to pay attention to it. So it is true that when you get a pay rise, you are made happy.
Yeah, of course.
But not for very long.
No, it's short-lived.
And what we don't predict is the adaptation to it, right? That if it were if you were to continue to pay attention to the pay rise and remind yourself how happy you were from the pay rise, you would be made happy for a long time. But it quickly becomes something that you withdraw attention from. The arguments that you have with your family and friends are still the arguments. Pizza still tastes like pizza.
Yeah.
you know, all these things that are actually largely unaffected by income.
No, and I'm really glad you've actually brought up the fact that poverty, obviously, it's something I'm trying to talk about on this podcast a lot, that sometimes we don't choose the environment we're born into. We don't choose that kind of thing. And the same goes for nutrition in my field, that obviously there's huge discrepancies depending on the socioeconomic group or where you're born, what you surround yourself with. But there is one phrase that says, travel is the only thing that you can buy that makes you happier. Would you agree with that?
Wow, okay. I wasn't expecting that. I know. Where's that come from? That's come from a little bit left.
I can't remember where I pulled that out from now.
No, where did you get that from? You just made that up, didn't you?
I wish I were that good. I really wish I were.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it depends, doesn't it, I suppose? Well, I guess, I mean, if you're going to be having new experiences, right, let's kind of make it about that. So we know that new experiences are generally good for us. It's one of the reasons why time passes so slowly for children.
It does, yeah.
It's because they're constantly doing new things. Oh. When you get older...
It's like the time goes like that. There's just, you know, at the end of the year.
Yeah. Well, now, I mean, like, you know, when you're three and you're waiting for an egg to boil, it's like a lifetime.
Yeah.
So it's because you're constantly having new experiences. And so having new experiences is you know, makes us feel good. It kind of slows time down. So that's good. So if you travel to have a new experience, then that's good.
That makes so much sense.
Traveling, I mean, so one of the things that we know from... an accumulation of evidence is that when we think about the memories of experiences, we don't pay very much attention to duration.
Okay.
So you don't remember how. So when you go on holiday, you don't remember how long you went on holiday for. You remember the peak experience, so the moment that you had a fantastic time all together as a family or something, or actually maybe a really miserable time too. you might remember the end experience, you know, the kind of journey home that was either good or bad. but you don't remember how long you went away for. So if you're going to travel, I would suggest you do it in sort of short, sharp bursts. Really organise an event that's going to be really experiential and fun, or even maybe purposeful, and kind of, you know, do it and then come home again and then do something again quickly afterwards.
Oh my gosh, it's an excuse to book multitude of holidays.
Multitude of holidays, but I should say environmental impact is significant. Yes, right. Yes. So I wouldn't be recommending people taking lots of flights.
No, not weekly flights, please. The carbon footprint, just got to be careful. Is that the one?
Well, it is. But also, the fact that air travel is hugely subsidised. I mean, there's no tax on aviation fuel. Pollution costs are not accounted for. So we need to be a little bit more measured in our use of air travel, I think.
I think that's a really good point to raise as well. And actually, we're going to do a podcast, I'm not sure what time frame compared to now, on climate change. Mm-hmm. So it's something we should discuss. And we know, despite the pressures on us, obviously, to feel happy, so we all have days where we have negative emotions too. And from short term, I don't know, road rage or something, or this kind of thing.
Speaking from personal experience.
Well, when I used to try and drive in the city of London.
No one should drive in London. No, I know. That's a stupid thing to do in the first place.
I completely agree. I'm a big walker these days. But for something quite serious, like maybe grieving over a loved one. So why is it our bodies reacting this way? Is it a good thing to feel negative emotions if we're trying to be happy?
Yeah, you want some proportionality, don't you? I mean, if you're somebody who kind of someone close to you dies and you're unaffected, then there's probably something problematic in the relationships that you have, I would imagine. But you know, we are highly adaptive creatures. I mean, notwithstanding the fact that people experience significant mental health problems over long periods, most people, for significant proportions of their life, actually, you know, deal with stuff quite well. And we're not very good at predicting that. You know, we kind of imagine that something's going to happen, then it's going to be awful, and it's going to be awful forever. But just like the pay rise wears off, you know, bad things wear off too. And that's not to be disingenuous to the really significant things that do cause long-term harm. But, you know, most things people get over relatively quickly, and they mispredict that.
I mean, I use an analogy, and I'm not an expert in the subject, but with my clients in my clinic, if they're having a bad week, I kind of use a wave analogy, saying, you know, sometimes you'll be at the peak, the crest of the wave, and then it will go down again, but it has to go up again. So it's like a philosophy that is always evolving.
Yeah, I mean, some people, there is increasing evidence that there's genetic differences in the variability that people experience, right? So there's been a lot of work looking at resilience, right? So looking at, you know, how some people react really badly to the sort of same event that someone else doesn't react so badly to. But it's actually more about sensitivity, right? So some people, those people that react really badly to negative stuff often will be those that react really positively to positive stuff. And some people are just rougher seas, other people are calmer oceans.
I like that.
And I know, it's good, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
but so I think that the understanding those individual differences is really important, because often, and you see this a lot in the, you know, sort of happiness literature, is especially in the self-help genre, is this sort of one-size-fits-all approach for everybody. And people are different.
Oh, we are all about being unique on this podcast. So you're in the right place. What are your thoughts on the fact that gratitude is something that I know a lot of people speak about?
Yes.
Especially in some of these self-help books. But what are your views on gratitude and meditation?
Well, there is some research evidence on gratitude. There's been some good randomized controlled trials. And you know, people do generally feel happier, you know, improve their sense of pleasure and their sense of purpose when they are reminded, or when they remind themselves, and have interventions to remind themselves of feeling grateful. So that's good. I mean, meditation is somewhat different, I guess. It's a bit more effortful and requires, you know, training in some sense. And
I think it does as well. It's quite tricky.
Yeah, and you know, again, I mean, take mindfulness for example. I mean, I'm sure it's fantastic for some people. For me, the idea of coming on these retreats that some of these people go on fills me with horror. But you know, but that's fine.
Some people can go on silent retreats.
Could you imagine?
I couldn't personally do that. I admire anyone. No, I'm not.
I mean, they go for days.
I know, without saying a word to anyone.
But each to their own. But we can be mindful in the sense of paying attention to what we're doing and who we're with by avoiding distraction. So, you know, we're bound to at some point get onto social media, onto phones and onto technology.
We
can,
yeah.
you know, we can remove those from our experiences so that we can be mindful without having to do mindfulness.
Yeah. I mean, helping others is something I know that gives me kind of a happy feeling. Is that in human nature?
What sort of things do you do?
Well, helping others. I am one of those people.
Because I always say that and I wonder what they actually do.
They put on the spot. I'm one of those.
You're going to make
people...
something up now, aren't you?
No. Honestly, I keep a... Oh, you're going to think I'm a cheesy person now. So I keep a daily one task a day where I try and do something for someone else.
Oh, wow, you do actually do it.
I do actually. Well, today I bought, this is not your average good feel good thing, but I bought a pack of chocolate rice cakes for my hairdresser because I know they're her favourite. That's my thing. There you go.
You're making me feel like such a bad person. Well, helping others is really a really selfish thing to do. It's really good for us. It makes us feel happy. And so they also benefit, by the way, if you're helping somebody else that wants to be helped. So there's a massive win-win from that. And I think that, and I do have a chapter on altruism in Happy Ever After, where I sort of deconstruct this idea that helping other people sort of ought to be selfless in some sense, right? This is sort of idea that we shouldn't benefit ourselves from helping other people. And that's completely wrong. I mean, the evidence is very clear that you get much more pro-sociality, much more volunteering. Again, you know, evidence from randomized controlled trials when you tap into the self-interested reasons to help other people. So I think one of the things that we can do more to help other people is to remind people how good it makes them feel themselves.
Yeah, that's so true. The thing that's really, really rung true for me there is the fact that you are selfish by trying to not be selfish.
It's kind of,
you've got to get your head around it a little bit.
There's some weird definitions of what we define as selfish behaviour. I mean, it's interesting that, but it is interesting to some degree that we tend not to like people who show off about helping other people too much. That's quite interesting because we should be encouraging more of it and celebrating it more. So it's kind of interesting that we don't.
Yeah, almost like charity work, I suppose, as well, which is a way I guess some people may express that. So what are the key factors you think in a happy life? So we've discussed relationships. Oh, what about relationships with others?
Which, like intimate relationships?
Well, yeah, like having a partner or your best friends, surrounding yourself with lots of different people. Does that impact your levels every
day? Well, it's interesting. I mean, I gave a talk at the Hay Festival recently and there was a huge amount of press interest in... I said lots of things during the course of that talk. but one of the things is this was in the context of the narrative around getting married and particularly for women. And particularly for... you know, childless women in their 40s or whatever, or child-free women. I think it's better to say child-free rather than childless.
Okay.
So child-free women in their 40s are kind of often sort of looked on, you know, sort of sad, isn't it, that they haven't found anybody yet.
Yeah.
And actually the evidence is that, you know, large numbers of them are doing perfectly well.
Yeah,
again,
really
we have no randomised controlled trials, so we don't know whether it's causal. But, you know, the evidence is, in my mind, pretty clear that men benefit more from marriage than women do. And yet the sort of expectation is that women should be doing it and they feel bad if they don't. And there's lots of single women who are perfectly happy without being married. And so relationships are important to us. But what single people, and men too, are good at doing is having good relationships with friends.
Yes.
That sometimes married people don't have, right? Mm. You kind of marry into a family.
Mm. Yeah, and then you're...
and you're forced to take on the in-laws.
Yeah.
You know, which sometimes you like, but often, you know, you might not. And so... you know, single people use their time very well.
Mm.
They're also much more pro-social as well. So, you know, charities are more likely to be started up by single people. They leave more money in their wills to charities. It's the married people that are more selfish.
Oh, I love that you've brought that up because there is a huge stigma for females in society.
There is, isn't there?
They have to get married. They have to have a baby before the age of 40 even. And like you said, people are looked upon as, oh, why? Why would you not choose
it? To talk about the selfish thing, I mean, women that don't have children, not so much men, are seen as selfish, as if bringing another person into a heavily overly populated
world,
isn't a selfish thing to do. It's a talk in Happy Ever After about this. If you have one, so if you were to engage in half a dozen environmentally friendly behaviours that would be seen as quite significant, like driving half as many miles next year as last year, that's about 500 tons of CO2 offset. Wow. One fewer child born, 10,000 tons.
Yes.
So there are some very good environmental reasons not to have kids, as well as any happiness related ones.
Yeah, no, and again, very important to mention, because it's always about, as well, if we move on to another key factor, what about appreciating the really small things in life as well? Because you've mentioned about gratitude, but spending time in nature, for instance.
Well, so there are some, I mean, whilst it's absolutely true there are huge individual differences, there are some things that are pretty much universally good for us. And biophilia, you know, being around nature,
yeah,
is good. I think it'd be overclaiming to say for all of us.
Yeah.
But pretty much for all of us, I think. Even for those people who say, I don't like nature, I'm a city boy, I don't want to go outdoors.
Yeah.
But actually just being around trees or around plants and stuff does make people feel better, even those that imagine that it won't.
Yeah, no, I was looking at, so apparently there's something called fractiles, which mean, I'm just going to try and phrase this right because I'm regurgitating information right now. I hope I get it right for my listeners. When you're looking at a tree or a plant, apparently that then impacts your parasympathetic nervous state. There's been some research that it does impact you and calm you.
There you go.
So it's like internal calming, just being in nature.
Yeah.
And I found that absolutely fascinating.
Good luck with that in central London.
Well, yeah, I know. This is why I need to escape.
Well, this is part... Well, actually, I mean, it's part... I'm going to tell everyone to leave London, but I mean, it's part of the reason why people should leave London.
I completely agree. Okay, although I'm biased because I'm not from London originally, so...
But there are some good... I mean, there are... You know, it's not... most of the capital cities or large urban populations, which tend to be capital cities around the world, do report the lowest levels of happiness.
Wow.
Highest levels of happiness in the UK from the kinds of questions that I'm not a huge fan of that we talked about earlier, but still we can make some inference from them, are, I think, Northern Ireland and parts of Scotland.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, God. It really does go to show. So if that moves us on to comparing ourselves to others,
yes,
I think.
Which we do in London a lot.
Well, yeah, we're in such a compact environment. Yeah. I just think, and with social media.
Yes.
So let's delve into the impact of, let's do comparing first, and then we'll discuss the internet world.
Yeah, I think that will naturally go into it because I think social media magnifies those kinds of comparisons.
Yeah.
I mean, look, we've probably evolved to compete and compare. We get better mates if we're successful. So the question then is on what dimensions do we compare and compete?
Mm.
And it could be possible, as we talked a bit earlier, that to make it around pro-sociality. So if you type into Google who pays the most tax, you do not get a name of anybody. You get how you get tax avoidance schemes. You get which countries have the lowest tax rates.
Really?
If you put into Google who's the richest, well, it's man largely in the world, you immediately get Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos.
Of course, yeah.
You immediately get information on who's the richest.
Yeah.
So we could reframe that, but that comparison is really significant. And you can imagine an analogy of being stuck in a traffic jam.
Okay.
With two lanes.
Yeah.
Okay, you're in one lane. Both lanes have stopped.
Yeah.
The other lane starts moving.
Oh, the worst feeling in the
world.
Right.
So there's two things. There's two things at play.
Okay.
But the most prominent one is, fuck, I wish I was in the other lane.
I know. Right? How can I get
there? That's the one. And that's the comparison one where other people doing better than you makes you feel really bad.
Yeah.
There's actually, though, a signalling effect going on, which is positive, which if they're moving, we're going to be moving soon too.
Hmm.
So in some poorer countries in the world and parts of the world, in rural China and India, for example, when other people's income rises, there's sometimes a positive effect on your own happiness because it's a signal that you're going to get richer.
Oh.
But most of the time, in most countries, and especially in the UK, the comparison effect is exactly the one that you immediately thought of, is I wish I was in the other lane. So that comparison, you know, and there's some really good data that, you know, shows, for example, that if you have a lottery winner in your neighbourhood, then the likelihood of bankruptcies being filed in that coming 12 months increases.
Oh.
Right? So as if other people there's a contagion effect. It's literally like pollution.
Yeah.
That this other person, this rich person pollutes you in a way that makes you feel like you need to try and keep up.
Isn't that, I've read a lot about lottery winners. I don't know why. Maybe it was also because I'd seen a program on TV talking about the lives after they'd won the lottery. And I was like, ooh, how interesting. But it must be really, really difficult, that sudden change of lifestyle, and for the people around you as well.
Hold up. What was that?
Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
But with comparison on social media.
Yeah.
So I'm a big, big fan of supporting other people, and I've got lots of friends, and I'm genuinely from a good place, very happy for them. But
yeah.
Sometimes you cannot help, and it must happen, I would say, at least once a day, where you look through social media, you see likes on someone else's page, or you see what someone's up to, or they're away on holiday here, and you just feel pretty rubbish. I mean, how do you even describe that, and how can we move away from seeking approval? Or
I know, well, it's in, I mean, social media, like, I mean, of course, like most things are never good or bad in themselves. It's the way in which we use them, and in relation to the narratives, for example, it could be that social media is very helpful insofar as if you are different in some way, you can find lots more different people out there now in a way that you couldn't before. You were the only one in the village.
True.
So now you can find lots of other people like
it
you.
It has created careers.
Online. So you can be different and sort of celebrate some of that variation
and meet
more.
Friends that you wouldn't have had that are like-minded.
Exactly. But counterbalancing that and probably overwhelming it is the magnification of these narratives, right? So, you know, weddings, for example, before people used to show off spending a fortune for 100 people that turned up.
Yeah.
Now they can show off not only to those 100 people, but to all their Instagram followers.
Yeah.
And so there's a kind of magnification of this.
There's also a pressure on people to showcase this. So people asking, oh, when are you going to show photos of your wedding, or what are you going to be wearing? It's very interesting.
Well, you know, there's data to show that the more you spend on your wedding, the more likely you are to get divorced.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Gosh.
Yeah. I mean, lots of different reasons. I mean, obviously, partly debt, of course. That's, that's one
reason.
Yeah,
of course.
But that sort of public kind of affirmation that's required in order to show that you love somebody, you need the rest of the world to see it.
Like a spread an OK mag that you see these celebrities having.
Yeah, you kind of do. What is that sort of a bit protesting too much, isn't it?
Yeah, it must be. I couldn't even put myself in the shoes of that sort of relationship, having everybody in the world kind of make a judgment about you and your life and the expectations. But how do we move away from it then? What can we do to be truly happy in ourselves?
Well, with social media, I think it requires regulation. I mean, I mean, we've got a daughter who's going to be starting secondary school this year, so it's very pertinent for us. It does seem that some of the, I mean, again, there's no randomized controlled trials in it, and it does all to do with content. It's not just how long people spend on social media, but there is some evidence suggesting it's more harmful for teen and preteen girls than it is for boys, who seem to be largely unaffected on average.
Is that
by
from
this.
A body image perspective, health status?
I think it's just, I mean, who
mental
knows?
Health,
I mean, of
yeah.
course, these things, there's huge variations within genders that to sort of talk about girls and boys as distinct groups is kind of doing it a disservice. But the way that girls tend to interact with one another, as they always have in social environments as well, but it's sort of magnified again in social media, it could be quite pernicious.
Yeah.
And so I think it's, you know, that's kind of hard for girls to navigate their way through that. And so, you know, I think like with smoking, you know, we're going to require regulation to limit the use or the types of content that young people, whilst brains are still being developed. See, that's the thing.
When we don't have the data.
So you probably got your... When did you get a smartphone? How old were you?
Oh, gosh. I think that... So I used to have a Nokia 3310 when I was about 15, 14. I had Snakes, that game, on it. And I think I got my first iPhone when I was like 19.
Yeah, so you...
So
your brain hasn't fully developed at that stage. It takes to about your mid-20s, but it's pretty much there.
Mm.
But if you'd got that phone 5-7 years before,
oof,
very different impact that it may have had on you, because you're essentially, your brain is more vulnerable to those kinds of influences.
So it's a fascinating area, and we don't know until we see a before and after, I suppose.
Well, until we see the harm. I mean, that's what's, and that's why it's a bit like smoking, because we kind of knew correlationally, and actually there was some good trials as well, but we knew about smoking long before we did anything about it. And we're sort of going to be left in the same... People may well ask in a decade or two's time, why didn't you do something sooner?
I know. For me, obviously, in my nutrition clinic, we get a lot of people that are now being referred from, I don't know, various schools around the country, boarding schools, people getting in touch, because the schools have been monitoring the social media accounts somehow. I don't know how they do that, but they're picking up on perhaps pro-anorexic accounts or different, you know, different fields and different areas that are really, really worrying and damaging. And I think it's about time we get this regulation. We've been waiting for so many
years. Well, we can't... What's really telling, isn't it? There's lots of things that are really telling, but one thing that's really telling is that these tech giants themselves don't let their children go anywhere near their own technologies.
How do you know this? How? They've obviously got the right idea. So what causes our mindset to change as we get older then? Compare a child's mind, like you said.
Yeah.
Why is it so different to an adult's mindset?
Oh, I don't know. That's a really good question. I'm not into a lot of life course research. I mean, there's more plasticity, isn't there, I guess? I mean, but there's still plasticity in older people's brains, much more than we kind of anticipate. We kind of imagine that we become fixed, immovable people as we're into adulthood, but that's actually not true. Our minds are quite plastic.
Yeah.
But there must be more plasticity in children.
Yeah.
But I do think this... we tend to see a diminishing of arousal in older groups. There's more of a reporting of contentment and calm than there is in younger people. But that's not true for everybody. I mean, some people still remain excitable,
of course,
when they get older. And that's why music's so important. I think we must say something about music.
Please do. It's one of my favourite things.
Because there is so much evidence on the beneficial effects of music. It literally is the only stimulus that lights the whole brain up.
Wow.
It literally lights the whole brain up.
Yeah.
Music therapy has been used in a whole range of different environments with different treatments and conditions, but we all know if we listen to music that we enjoy, of course people have different music tastes, but
they do.
Listening to music that they enjoy, you feel good. And you don't feel good just for the time that you're listening to it, you feel good afterwards. So when I say some of these things, I say listen to more music, people say, well, that's fucking amazing, you're a genius. I need you to tell me that. I say, well, why don't you do more of it then? And it's because we're not designing our environments. We're not making it easy. The simple behavioral science lesson is, if you want to do something, make it easy.
Yeah.
And if you don't want to do something, make it hard.
I love that.
It's a basic sort of, you know, 101 insight. But we don't make it easy for ourselves to do the things that are going to make us feel good.
And what you may not know about me is I'm actually an ex-professional singer. So I'm a soprano by trade.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, so before I trained to be a nutritionist. And one of the activities I set my clients now, especially if I'm looking with disordered eating behaviours, is I ask them to play music while they're eating their meal, because it, as you said, I didn't know that it lit up the whole brain, but I knew that it enabled my clients to actually finish their meal or really enjoy the food more
that
they're eating.
So do they pay attention to the music?
Yeah, they listen more to the music, and it helps distract from any unwanted negative voices, you know, an inner critic inside the head.
So these are people that wouldn't be wanting to eat the food
precisely,
otherwise.
Precisely, a negative relationship with food. And it's such a beneficial exercise. I find it works with everyone, and even singing. So I do a lot of singing workshops when I go away or do talks and things, or I get people to breathe. It gets people going. It really changes the energy in the room.
That's amazing.
So yeah, what you've just said just makes a lot of everybody... I think you should just sing in your shower.
Yeah, well, that's about the best place for me to sing, because people wouldn't want to hear it publicly. I'd love to be able to sing.
Yeah, it's...
I would literally give a limb, probably.
Really? Really?
Or maybe a finger, maybe a limb's too much.
Oh, wow, yeah.
But I'd love to be, or maybe three or four fingers, but I'd love to be able to sing at weddings and stuff, yeah, or parties, yeah, and not be everyone turning and looking at me like, oh my God.
Do you know one thing I always say to people that say that, because I am very blessed.
You are blessed, you're so lucky.
Lucky, yeah. And I do love singing at weddings and different events. I've sung at many places in my career, but I say everyone can sing. It's just some people have a different, more pleasing kind of sound to others. It doesn't mean you can't do it.
Yeah,
you
still get. I did get a singing lesson bought for me though once years ago because my voice was so bad.
Okay.
And he did say he was pressing the keys and I was making some noises, and he said, "Yeah, we could have a lot of lessons and you wouldn't get very much better."
So. Well, to be honest, this is a case of the next question, which is the grass is always greener. So perhaps if you could sing, you never know, you might not. Well, I doubt it, but some people may not enjoy it if they could. But why is it that we often want what we can't have then? Why does that happen?
I don't know. I mean, there must be something. I mean, we're largely an optimistic species because we would never have explored new territories and new terrains if we hadn't been optimistic.
Like, yes.
There's something that, you know, the grass is greener.
Yes.
And so that motivates us to action. To go and try new things.
Like
and
we you said are, about the holidays.
Yeah, and we are largely optimistic. I mean, there is an optimism bias amongst the human condition generally, on average, right? Mm. So we kind of do expect things to be better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that motivates action. So that would partly explain it. But the downside, I suppose the downside is you sort of imagine it's about where you think attention is going to be allocated. So if you imagine someone else, like, so I say that, oh, if I could sing, I'd be happy.
Yes.
I'm going to think about I'm paying attention to singing.
Yes.
All the time in my life when I can sing. And of course I wouldn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? Pizza would still taste like pizza. People
yes.
would still get on my nerves.
Yes.
I mean, so, you know, so you could have mispredict where attention is going to be, you know, focused. And
yeah.
that's why people imagine that rich people, for example, are always happy because they're thinking about how rich they are.
Yeah,
but
no,
they're not
at all. No, that makes sense. And the last question I kind of have from me is laughter.
Laughter, yes.
Yes. There's something about...
Why don't we talk about that more?
I think we should, because I find some days I realised in the hairdresser actually earlier, I haven't laughed yet today because we had a little giggle. I was like, oh, it's the first time I've laughed today. Does that impact happiness?
Yeah, even a false smile does, right? So if you hold a pencil in your teeth and put a fake smile on, it elevates your mood. It's interesting because one of the things about academic... I mean, I love being an academic.
Yeah.
I'm not always such a big fan of other academics.
And, I think that's probably a unanimous thing amongst academics.
Well, they're very serious and very intense. And, you know, it is important work, you know, but you can still sometimes have a laugh.
Yeah.
About it and about yourself and be...
Completely.
Be self-deprecating and kind of, you know, and that's okay. Yeah. And it doesn't do a disservice. And I notice this much more in North America, although it's to some large extent true in the UK, is that so if you laugh at your work or something, then it sort of makes it devalued in some way. And of course that's not true.
No, I've had a similar battle here with being a health professional that wants to have a bit of fun sometimes. It's difficult. Some people won't take you as seriously if you are seen to have a bit of a laugh sometimes. It's a hard balance to strike.
It is. And also, you know, this because this plays into these narratives. You know, you're expected to behave in particular ways.
Yeah, you're expected to wear a
lab coat
based
on your profession.
If you are a scientist.
I mean, you know, as I've... You know, it's on public record that I don't read novels. My God. I mean, the abuse I've got.
Really?
From people. Well, because LSE professors, I mean, God, they must read. I mean, I think people sometimes don't understand that there's a difference between novels and books. I do read lots of nonfiction.
Yeah.
Just don't read novels. But somehow my life is completely empty by not doing what's expected of me in my, you know, job. And it's, or, you know, going to the gym. I mean, it's a weird thing for academics to work out, by the way.
I don't understand this either. And also, I've had a similar situation.
I mean, bodybuilding is not a middle-class, pastime at all anyway. If you've been to any bodybuilding competitions, they're all working-class people.
Yeah.
But to be an academic and do bodybuilding, I mean, that's just like, I mean, that's, you know, like you're judged for doing that. Whereas if I played, I don't know, croquet or tennis or something, that would be, would be fine. Or golf.
There you go.
Or golf. That'd all be fine. So,
yeah.
So there's some real expectations, not only about how people should live their lives in work, but what they should do with their leisure time.
Yeah. No, it's true. And I think, again, this must all be impacting our happiness immensely. So that moves me on to questions we've got from some followers.
Oh, okay.
So you won't have seen these, but I've got them all in front of me now. So Laura has asked, how can I ensure I don't have any regrets when I'm on my deathbed? Gosh, that's a very serious question. I want to make sure I've lived my life to the full. I mean, do you have the answer there?
Yeah, I mean, I would say not to worry too much about your deathbed.
Yeah.
Because that would be privileging one moment over all others.
Okay.
And it's not obvious that we should privilege the deathbed over other moments. Mm. But insofar as you are going to regret things, you regret unresolved uncertainties. Mm. So it's that sort of imagination about what could have been were it to happen rather than what did happen. Because if it happens, then again, you know, most things we make sense of and we deal with and we interpret in ways that actually make us in the end feel better in some sense, right?
Yeah.
But it's the sort of niggling unresolved uncertainties. What happened what would happen if I'd done that instead? So so generally I would think if you're thinking of doing something, do it.
Do it. That's the best example. Live your life.
Because the worst that can happen is you don't like it, you don't do it again, and you find some way of resolving it to make sense of why you did it.
Yeah, no, it's true. Good answer. Very thorough answer. Anastasia. Yeah, no, I was very impressed.
It's the first time you've been impressed in this whole thing.
No, don't be
thanks for that. It's taken you 40 minutes to be impressed.
I am immensely impressed.
Oh, whatever.
Anastasia said, if I lose a bit, this is a good one. If I lose a bit of weight, I know I'll be happier. I mean, I hear this a lot, but I know it's so difficult. Where could I be going wrong?
Well, first of all, that speaks directly to that prediction error that I was talking about before. You imagine you're going to be paying attention to something when it changes. So when I'm rich or when I've lost weight, but you're just going to recalibrate in a sense where you are. You know, where you are. Pizza's still going to taste like pizza. Friends are still going to annoy you. And actually, there's a very weak association between happiness and weight. I mean, morbid obesity is bad for people because they can't really do very much. But you know, kind of there's a judgment that we make about other people, particularly people that are overweight and obese, that they must be miserable because look at them.
Which is terrible in society. They're not. This is what I call, again, and it ties very nicely into fat shaming, which is a topic we're going to discuss as well. Because how can you possibly judge someone on their size?
No, well, I totally agree. I mean, I talk a lot about that in the health chapter in Happy Ever After. I mean, we make these huge... What it is that I think that happens is that we have... Sometimes we have a sort of system one, like an immediate reaction to something that we don't like, for example. And then we sort of try and find justifications and validation for that.
Yes.
So people will say, obesity costs the NHS a fortune. Mm. Well, actually, does it? Compared to all those people being skinny and living a lot longer and spending a lot of money on social care and other care costs, there's no one's actually really done a proper, as far as I can tell,
comparison.
An appraisal of what the world would look like in the counterfactual.
Mm.
But then we look for validations. Oh, well, they must be miserable. Well, actually, no, again, you know, they're not. And I say obesity and morbid obesity has long-term consequences that people might want to avoid. But being a little bit overweight is absolutely fine. I mean, you know, but people are fine. We shouldn't judge them for not being so.
And this is the societal norm. But I don't think just losing weight will make anyone happier at all. That's something like we've discussed is unique to
you. And it's also the thing, I mean, this is really, I mean, this is quite almost like not meant to be pessimistic, but the chances of you sustain, I mean, you know this, that once you've gained weight, of losing it and keeping it off are very, very small. Epidemiological data, probably somewhere between 5% at most, probably about 1%.
Keep it off.
You know, keep it off because as you know, you physiologically change.
Yeah.
And the your caloric requirements when you've been fat and now you're not are less.
Yeah.
And so it's just, I mean, not a case of giving up, but accepting the fact that probably this is going to be.
And there's different elements. You mentioned you were speaking at Hay Festival as well. So we had Professor Giles Yeo on. I don't know if you got to meet him there, but he's a geneticist and he was talking a lot about different weight interactions and how we've all even got genes that can dictate our appetite and our weight and so many things. But another question we've got, very good questions today, guys. I can relate to this. Every time I finish a project, this is from Noel, I feel really happy. But then it goes so quickly that I can't wait to set myself another goal to smash. Why am I never truly satisfied and fulfilled?
Well, maybe Noel needs lots of goals. some people are more goal. You know, again, accepting things about ourselves is really important,
acceptance.
Right? You know, I mean, acceptance is just like, I'm one of those people that just needs lots of projects and goals.
Yeah.
But you can be too goal-directed. It's really interesting that we talk a lot about people who have no ambition, no goals. Mm. We focus much more attention on those people. But the obsessives,
yeah,
that kind of require constant goals.
Yeah.
And it's a really cliched and really cliche thing to say, but it's the journey, not the destination.
Yes.
So,
yes,
you know, you kind of really need to enjoy,
yeah,
the process of getting there.
Yeah. There was an interesting school of thought on one of the master practitioner I completed in the psychological interventions to eating disorders. And I'm not saying this is gospel at all, but people that choose to do marathons consistently, there's something about them where they need to be punishing their body almost, or achieving such a high standard consistently, that they are more likely to engage in disordered eating behaviors.
Yeah. Well, it's a fixation on achievement and accomplishment. I mean, running marathons is very silly anyway.
It's very difficult for your body it's not great.
But you know, in most
health.
Extreme mountaineers, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they literally die.
Yeah.
I mean, mountaineers die.
There's a huge stat, isn't there? Everest every year, people that don't make it.
And they don't even enjoy it, right?
No.
Because I think about, what, 3/4 or 4/5 of accidents happen on the way down, not on the way up.
Oh, really?
So you don't enjoy the summit.
Oh, God.
Because the worst bit's yet to come.
Yeah.
They get off the mountain, they'll all say never again, and within weeks they're climbing another mountain. So it's like a pathology.
Yeah.
This sort of need to constantly be accomplishing and achieving.
Oh, gosh. Well, that moves me on to my favourite part of our podcast, which is our fact or fiction round.
Oh, my God.
Okay, so...
You didn't tell me about any of this.
I know.
Oh, God, we're nearly done. Right,
we're nearly done.
I need to go. Sorry. Yeah, we haven't got time for this.
So you have to answer fact or fiction. I'm not letting you out of this one.
All right, go on then.
Get your water. Make sure you're settled.
Go on, then. You're going to give me a little nod, like, to let me know which it is.
Right, no, you're all on your own. You're on your own. Are you ready?
Yeah, go on then.
Okay.
Go on then.
Happiness is a choice.
Oh, my God, is that a fact? I mean...
You can say
Oh, come on, I can't
fiction.
Say... I mean, oh, come on, you can't expect an academic to pick one or other.
This is what makes it a fun round. You can explain a little bit.
My first answer, a bit of both, faction. I mean, I can't, of course.
Perfect. More money makes us happy.
Yes, if you're poor, no, if you're rich.
There you go. We shouldn't rely on others to make us happy.
We should. I mean, but we do need to... We do need other people. We are happy when we're around other people. I'm not entirely Buddhist in this sense.
Yeah, yeah, no. Everyone has the potential to be happy.
Fact.
I'm so pleased it's a fact.
Largely fact.
Okay, largely fact. Let's take that one. It's the simple things that make us happy.
Yeah, fact. Let's go for that. Definite fact. I'm getting into this now.
Great. Happiness takes time to cultivate.
No, you can do it quickly. Fiction.
Love. It is possible to be happy every single day.
No.
I'm really relieved you just said that's fiction, because I sometimes I'm like, I can't.
That's kind of expecting a bit much, isn't it?
Yeah. You need a partner to be happy.
Fiction.
You're either happy or you're not.
Fiction.
Comparison is the thief of joy.
Oh, largely fact.
Okay. Well done. That was our quickfire round.
You
completed the fact or fiction round. So that nearly wraps up our episode. But as with every guest, we finish with a food for thought. So mine today would be that there is now more pressure than ever before to be healthy and happy. And yet we seem to have lost the concept of balance and any happy in between. So much of the advice we receive these days about our physical and mental health points to extreme approaches like we've just discussed. But the reality is that balance, variety and enjoyment are important in leading a happy and healthy life. So we should all be encouraging and supporting each other to live a lifestyle that makes us feel great. So live your life, if you can, free from social comparisons. And it sounds very, you know, all wishy-washy, but it's very true. Poor health and a terrible diet, because just because someone's influential and has decided to give up carbs or follow a trend, it doesn't mean it's right for you. You are all completely unique. Just as if you are a vegan or a vegetarian, no one should dictate your lifestyle choice and how you should change your personal diet. It's important that you do you. And that's not only true of your diet, but in all other aspects of your life too. So, Paul, if I could ask you to share one...
I thought we were done.
You're nearly done.
Don't let up, do you?
I know.
I was listening to your final... That was absolutely brilliant. I thought that was it. Now what are you going to ask
me? I'm very
to
prepared.
Do?
I want you to leave our listeners with one food for thought that you think everyone should take away about happiness or about anything really you think could benefit them listening.
Can I make it about what they think about other people? I think it's to just ease off on the judgments
100%
that we make of other people.
I love that.
I think that will make us feel happier, and it will make them feel happier too. Just let up and just, you know, let people live lives that are best for them that may not be the same as the way that you live.
I actually think that was a pretty beautiful food for thought. Paul, thank you so much for coming on Food for Thought.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening. It really is heartening to know there's such a craving to hear from expert voices in a world full of confusing advice. If you enjoyed this episode, you'll love what's coming next week. So make sure you click subscribe to be the first to hear it. And please do leave a 5-star review. It really does help to get our podcast out there and hopefully help more people. So we'd really appreciate it. For more information about my Retrition Clinic, books, healthy recipes, events, retreats, and so much more, please visit Retrition.com, subscribe to my newsletter, and follow me at Retrition on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.